"Well, sometimes we back and sometimes they back," he said. After about 5 miles, Grant saw this new rule of the road demonstrated when they came face to face with a traction engine. It was a diminutive specimen of its kind, but formidable enough in the circumstances. On one side was the hill, and on the other a small rocky ravine. With the greatest good humour, the driver reversed and backed his unwieldy vehicle until he could run it into the bank in a siding for road metal. The traction engine chuffed complacently past, and the journey was resumed. In all the 36 miles they met only 2 more obstacles, both motors. In one case they grazed past by a mutual withdrawing of skirts, the near wheel of the mail car being in a ditch, and the near wheel of the other in a bank of heather and boulders. In the other case, the car proved to be a Ford, and with the mongrel adaptability of its kind took without parley to the moor, and with complete insouciance swept bumping past the stationary mail car, what time the drivers exchanged unintelligible greetings. This display of amphibiousness seemed to astonish no one, and though the car was now full to overflowing, no remark was made. It was evidently a daily occurrence. With the laden state of the car in his mind, Grant wondered what would happen to the people along the road who would have no means of travelling. The same fear had occurred to a little old woman who had been waiting by a roadside cottage for the car. As it slowed down and the driver descended to her assistance, she looked scaredly at the crowded benches and said, "How are you going to make room, Andy?" "Be quiet," said Andy cheerfully. "We never left anyone yet." "Be quiet," Grant learned, was not a reproof in this country, and had nothing to do with its English meaning. It was an expression of half-jocose refutal, and on occasions of straightforward admiration tinged with disbelief. On Andy's lips it meant that the old lady was what a lowlander would call havering, and certainly he was as good as his word. Room was found, and no one seemed to suffer very badly, unless it was the hens in the coop at the back, which had been rolled slightly sideways. But they were still vociferously alive when their proud owner, waiting at the head of a track that led apparently nowhere, claimed them and bore them away in a wheelbarrow. Several miles before Garney, Grant smelt the sea, that seaweedy smell of the sea on an indented coast. It was strange to smell it so unpreparedly in such unsea-like surroundings. It was still more strange to come on it suddenly as a small green pool among the hills. Only the brown surge of the weed along the rocks proclaimed the fact that it was ocean and not moor loch. But as they swept into Garney, with all the éclat of the most important thing in 24 hours, the long line of Garney sands lay bare in the evening light, a violet sea creaming gently on their silver placidity. The car decanted him at the flagged doorway of his hostelry, but hungry as he was, he lingered in the door to watch the light die beyond the flat purple outline of the islands to the west. The stillness was full of the clear, faraway sounds of evening. The air smelt of peat smoke and the sea. The first lights of the village shone daffodil clear here and there. The sea grew lavender, and the sands became a pale shimmer in the dusk. And he had come here to arrest a man who had committed murder in a London queue. Chapter 11. Carninish. Grant had got little information from Andy, the mail car driver, not because the driver was ignorant. After all, he had presumably driven Lamont these 36 miles over the hills only 2 days before. But because Andy's desire to find out all about himself was, surprisingly enough, just as strong as his to find out about Lamont, and he brushed aside Grant's most hopeful leads with a monosyllable or a movement of his head, and produced instead leads of his own. It was a game that soon palled, and Grant had given him up long before he had resigned himself to knowing no more of Grant. and now the landlord of the Garney Hotel, interviewed in the porch after breakfast, proved equally unhelpful, this time through genuine ignorance. Where the mail driver would have been intensely interested in whatever happened at Carninish, which was his home and his resting place each night, the landlord was interested only in Garney, and in Garney only as it affected his hotel. "Come for some fishing, sir," he said. And Grant said yes, that he had thoughts of fishing the Finlay if that were possible. "Yes," the man said. "That's just 4 mile at the back of the hill beyond. Perhaps you'll know the country." Grant thought it best to disclaim any knowledge of the district. "Well, there's a wee village the other side on Loch Finlay, but you're better here. It's a wee poky place of an hotel they have there, and they have nothing but mutton to eat." Grant said they might do worse. "Yes, you'd think that the first day and maybe the second, but by the end of a week the sight of a sheep on the hill'd be too much for you. We can send you over in the ford every day if you're not fond of walking. You'll have a permit, I suppose." Grant said that he had thought there would be some water belonging to the hotel. "No, all that water belongs to the gentleman who has Carninish House. He is a Glasgow stockbroker. Yes, he's here. At least he came a week ago, if he's not gone again." "Well, if I can have the ford now, I'll go over and see him." Fishing was the only excuse which would allow him to wander the country without remark. "What did you say his name was?" he asked, as he stepped into a battered ford alongside a hirsute Jehu with a glaring eye. "He's a Mr. Drysdale," the landlord said. "He's not over-generous with the water, but perhaps you'll manage it." With which cold comfort Grant set off on a still colder drive over the hills to the Finlay Valley. "Where is the house?" he asked the hirsute one, whose name he learned was Roddy, as they went along.
"At Carninish."
"Do you mean right in the village?" Grant had no intention of making so public an appearance at this early date.
"No, it's the other side of the river from the village."
"We don't go through the village?"
"No, the bridge is before you come to the village at all."
As they came to the edge of the divide, the whole new valley opened map-like before Grant's fascinated gaze several hundreds of feet below. There were no fields, no green at all except on the border of the river that ran, a silver thread, through scattered birch to the distant sea loch. It was a brown country, and the intensity of the sea's blue gave it a foreign air, fairylands forlorn with a vengeance, Grant thought. As they ran seawards down the side of the hill, he noticed two churches and took his opportunity.
"You have enough churches for the size of the village." "Well," said Roddy, "you couldn't be expecting the wee freeze to go to the UF. That's the UF, down there, Mr. Logan's."
He pointed down to the right over the edge of the road, where a bald church and a solid four-square manse sheltered in some trees by the river.
"The wee free is away at the other end of the village by the sea."
Grant looked interestedly out of the corner of his eyes at the comfortable-looking house that sheltered his quarry.
"Nice place," he said. "Do they take boarders?"
No, Roddy thought not. They let the house for a month in the summer. The minister was a bachelor, and his widowed sister, a Mrs. Dinmont, kept house for him, and his niece, Mrs. Dinmont's daughter, was home for holidays just now. She was a nurse in London. No word of another inmate, and he could not pursue the subject without making the always curious Highlander suspicious.
"Many people at the hotel here?"
"Three,"
said Roddy. As befitted the retainer of a rival concern, there was nothing he did not know about the inn at Carninish. But though all three were men, none of them was Lamont. Roddy had the history and predilections of all of them at his fingertips. Carninish House lay on the opposite side of the river from the village, close to the sea, with the high road to the north at its back. "You'd better wait," Grant said, as Roddy pulled up before the door. And with what dignity Ruddy's method of coming to a halt had left him, he descended onto the doorstep. In the hall was a lean, rather sour-looking man in good tweeds. The stockbroker's got a party, thought Grant. He had quite unconsciously pictured the stockbroking gentleman as round and pink and too tight about the trouser legs. It was therefore rather a shock when the lean man came forward and said, "Can I do anything for you?" "I wanted to see Mr. Drysdale." "Come in," said the man, and led him into a room littered with fishing tackle. Now Grant had intended, quite shamelessly, to try sob stuff on the broker of his imagination, appealing to his generosity, not to spoil his holiday, but the sight of the real man made him change his mind. He took out his professional card and was gratified at the man's surprise. It was a compliment to the perfection of the disguise which his old fishing clothes afforded.
"Well, Inspector, what can I do for you?"
"I want you to be good enough to let me fish in the Finlay for a little. 2 days at most, I think. I think a man I want is in this neighbourhood, and the only way I can go about without attracting notice is to fish. I thought the hotel at Garney would have some fishing of their own, but it appears they haven't. I won't catch any fish, but I have fished a good deal, and I won't frighten everything in the river." To his surprise, a smile had come over the dour face of Mr. Drysdale.
"Inspector," he said, "I don't think you can have any idea how unique this occasion is, how utterly unique you are. Even in the 45 they didn't come here looking for anyone, and no one certainly has done it since. It's simply incredible. A criminal in Carninish and a CID inspector looking for him. Why, drunk and incapable is the most horrible crime that this neighbourhood has known since the flood."
"Perhaps my man thought of that," said the inspector dryly. "Anyhow, I promise I shan't bother you long if you give me the permission to fish."
"Certainly you can fish, any way you like. I'm going up the river now. Would you care to come with me? And I'll introduce you to the best pools. You might as well have a decent day's fishing if you're going to fish at all. Send that madman back to Garney."
Roddy was giggling with a maid in high-pitched Gaelic outside the open window, quite indifferent to the probable proximity of the gentleman.
"And tell him he needn't come back. I'll send you over in the evening, whenever you want to go."
Delighted at the unexpected graciousness on the part of the ill-favoured and reputedly ungenerous one, Grant dismissed Roddy, who received his congé with the grave respect of an ADC, but departed in a flurry of high, unintelligible cackle flung between himself and the maid. It sounded like the protesting row of an alarmed hen as she rockets over a fence to safety. When the noises had died away, Drysdale began in silence to collect his tackle for the river. He asked no more questions, and Grant was again grateful to him. To break the silence, which Drysdale had evidently no intention of breaking, he asked about the state of the river, and soon they were talking fishing with the freedom of two enthusiasts. They proceeded up the right bank of the river, that is, the opposite bank from the village and the manse, and Drysdale pointed out the pools and their peculiarities. The whole tawny, narrow, boulder-strewn river was not more than 6 miles long. It ran from a hill loch in an impetuous scramble, broken by still pools, to the sea at Carninish.
"I expect you'd like to be near the village," Drysdale said,
and suggested that the inspector should be left the lower half of the river, while he went up to the hill end, where he would probably spend the day, and to that Grant gratefully agreed. As they passed opposite the manse, Grant said,
"That the manse? Scotch clergymen seem to be very comfortable."
"They are," said Drysdale, with emphasis, but did not pursue the subject. Grant remarked on the apparent size of the house, and asked if they took boarders. It would be a good place to stay. Drysdale said that as far as he knew they did not take anyone, and he repeated Roddy's tale of the summer letting. He took leave of Grant with the abruptness of a shy man, and departed into the landscape, leaving Grant with the comfortable knowledge that he had an ally after his own heart, if the need for one should arise. Grant decided that he would start fishing perhaps 200 yards above the manse and work slowly down, taking his bearings and keeping an eye on the traffic to and from the house. On his side of the river there was a cart track that was almost a road, but on the other side there was, as far as he could see, only the path like a sheep track made by the feet of fishermen and gillies, so that anyone coming up river would come on his side. The manse was surrounded by a stone wall and faced away from him towards the high road on the other side of the river. Inside the wall was a row of scraggy firs, which effectually hid the detail of the house. Only gleams of whitewash and its 8 chimneys advertised its presence. At the back, the garden wall ran down to the river bank, and in the middle of the wall flanking the river was a small iron gate of the strictly utilitarian pattern popular in the Highlands. Though he could not see the high road immediately in front of the house, he had an uninterrupted view of the road on either side. No one could come or go from the house without his being aware of it, and he could stay where he was all day, unquestioned and unremarkable. It was an ideal situation. Grant sent the first cast hissing over the brown, shining water, and felt that life was good. It was too sunny for fishing, and his prospects of catching anything were meagre in the extreme, but a bigger catch lay to his hand. No one had mentioned that a stranger had arrived at the manse, but just as he had known on the Brixton Stair landing that the rooms were empty, Grant now had a feeling that his man was here. It was 11 before he began to fish, and for an hour or more no human activity other than his own broke the perfect peace of the morning. The 2 chimneys of the manse continued to smoke lazily into the bright air. The river babbled its eternal nursery rhyme song at his feet, and the water slid under his eyes with a mesmeric swiftness. Away to his right, beyond the distant bridge, the whitewashed houses by the shore showed over the slight rise of the moor, placid and sunlit as a stage setting. Grant began to feel that the whole thing was a picture, like the illustration from which he had first learned French in his youth, and that he was merely stuck down there by the river so that the picture might be complete. He was not Grant of the CID. He was pêcheur, to be pointed at with a wooden wand that tickled for the education of someone unknown. A postman coming from the village, leaning heavily and alternately on the pedals of a push-bike, broke the spell. It was still a picture, but he no longer belonged to it. It was a stage setting, one of the tiny exhibition ones, and he was the giant who was going to upset the whole box of tricks. And even as he thought it, the iron gate in the low wall of the manse swung open, and a girl came out, followed by a man. They shut the gate with difficulty and some laughter, and turned in single file down the footpath towards the bridge. Grant was still nearly 100 yards above the house, and neither of them had noticed him. The man was dressed in flannel trousers, an old trench coat, and a cap, and, except for his slightness, was as unlike the figure that had flung itself into the maelstrom of the Strand traffic as might well be. Grant was conscious of slight surprise. Revolving the matter during his long journey north, he had taken for granted that the man would look out of place. A London bookmaker's clerk would not be thrown into the Western Highlands at a moment's notice and look like an habitué. Well, it might not be the man after all. He hoped that they were making for the bridge and his side of the river, and not for the village. Surely if they had set out for the village, they would have gone out by the front way and walked along the high road. He watched in suspense until he saw the girl turn to the bridge, but there was still a chance that they were going straight on by the high road past Carninish House. Grant expelled a thankful breath as once more the girl turned riverwards and her companion joined her. They were coming up the river to him. They would pass only a few yards at his back. Industriously he flung a gleaming cast to the far side of the pool. He must not look their way again. In a minute or two they would have spotted him. He felt grateful to the ancient hat that collapsed more than drooped over his face, and to the shapeless garments that clothed him. His boots, too, were convincing, even to the most suspicious eye. It had been no case of dressing the part this time. He was the genuine article, and he was glad of it. There would be no amateurish cast to attract the practiced eye of Miss Dinmont. It must be Miss Dinmont. No suggestion of towniness about his clothes to call forth comment and her partner's instant interest. Suddenly, above the swirl of the water, he could hear their voices, raised because of the river's accompaniment. They were still laughing and animated, and apparently very good friends. Grant did not look round as they passed, nor did he look round immediately they had passed. If he glanced round now, a curious look from the man would have found his face revealed. But as they retreated upriver, he watched them. Was it Lamont? He tried to picture the man's walk again. Short of developing a limp, it is almost impossible to disguise a walk successfully. But he could not be sure, and then the man looked back suddenly. Grant was too far away to see his face, but the movement told him all he wanted to know. It was so vivid that before his reason had time to note it, his mind was back at the bottom of Bedford Street. There was no doubt of it. The man was Lamont. Grant's heart sang. Had Lamont known him? He thought not. How could he? It was mere bad conscience that had made him turn. If he asked Miss Dinmont about him, he would hear that no one who was not staying at Carninish House was allowed to fish the water, and he would be reassured. And now what? Go to the house when he returned and arrest him straight away? He had the warrant in his pocket. But suddenly he wanted to be assured, assured beyond the possibility of doubt, that Lamont was the man who had murdered Sorrel. They knew that he was the man who had quarrelled with Sorrel before his death, but that was not proof. The link that connected him with the knife was still missing. Before he would risk executing the warrant, he wanted to find out if Lamont's left hand bore the scar made by the knife. If it did not, then his case fell to pieces. However certain he himself might be, there must be no gaps in the evidence that would be put before a jury, and as long as there was a possible gap in the evidence, Grant had no intention of arresting anyone. He must get himself invited to the manse. It should not be difficult. If all else failed, he could fall into the river and appeal to them to dry him. He was eating the sandwiches provided by the Garney Hotel on a boulder half in and half out of the water when the couple came back. They went swinging past him down to the bridge and into the village, and presently he saw them reappear and come back to the manse by the high road. It was lunchtime. They were safely occupied for an hour at least and directly under his eye. He was carefully wrapping up the remaining sandwiches against a lean time to come when the local policeman appeared from upriver, pushing a punctured push bicycle. He slowed down when he saw Grant, if his previous leisurely progress could admit of any retarding without bringing him to a stop, and as Grant looked up, the last semblance of progression ceased.
"Having any luck, sir?"
asked the policeman. He had a face like a very pink waxwork, round and devoid of expression, and one glance at him made Grant thankful for the discovery of Drysdale. His pale blue eyes were fringed like a doll's, with fine black lashes, and an unconvincing moustache of silky black made a line on his upper lip. His fat, soft body could neither hurry nor take cover. That slow brain would be of no use whatever in an emergency. Grant admitted that he had caught nothing, but added that he had hardly expected to on such a bright morning.
"Yes, that's so," said the man. "But it won't be long like that. There's never a day but there's some rain here. You'll catch a fish before night."
Grant recognized this as the Highlander's usual desire to say the thing he thinks will be acceptable to his hearer.
"You haven't had the best of luck yourself," he said, indicating the tire. "'Indeed I have not. "'These roads are the very ruin on tires. "'Not but that I get an allowance for them, you know, "'but there's others isn't so lucky. "'Mr. Logan, the minister,' he jerked his head over at the manse, "'was just saying to me the other day "'that ministers should have a tire allowance as well as the police. "'He had three tires of his car punctured in 1 week. "'It would put even a minister in a temper.' "'Are there many motors in Carninish?' "'Well, Mr. Drysdale has two, as I expect you know, "'and Mr. Logan has one, but that's all. "'The other minister has a sidecar. "'But when someone wanted to hire, what did they do?' "'Oh, as to that, the hotel had a Ford for visitors. "'They hired out that when they weren't needing it themselves. "'A Ford, in the constable's opinion, evidently did not come under the heading "'Cars.' Presently the constable said, "'There's Mr. Logan away to see the new twins east at Arklas,' and Grant saw a rather heavy figure appear on the high road on the Garney side of the manse and proceed upriver at a businesslike place. "'I thought that road led only over the hill to Garney,' Grant said. "'Oh, yes, the high road, but—' "'Where the high road begins to go up the hill, "'there's a track goes off along the river "'to the croft you can see from the road. "'That's where he's going over now, Mr. Logan, "'and that's why he's walking. "'He's not very fond of walking.' "'The constable stayed for a long time, "'quite contentedly watching Grant fish, "'evidently glad to find interest for his eyes "'in a spot usually vacant.' And Grant revolved the problem of what he would do if the Logan car appeared suddenly on the high road beyond the manse, bound for Garney and the south. He would have no guarantee that Lamont was the passenger. It was too far away to identify anyone. He would have to make certain of that before he did anything. And then it would be a choice between getting busy on a telephone or giving chase. The Hotel Ford, he supposed. Or perhaps Drysdale would lend his car. But the afternoon wore on. The light took that white, hard, unsympathetic look that it does about 4 o'clock. The constable trundled his bicycle away to the village, where he could procure the patching materials which he had evidently forgotten, and still no one came from the manse. At 5 o'clock, Grant ate his remaining sandwiches and began to consider what other possibilities there were of cadging an entrance to the manse. The thought of a dip in the river, even if it was only a momentary one, became less and less pleasant as the evening wore on. His thoughts were interrupted, and his difficulties miraculously solved by heavy footsteps behind him. He looked round to see Mr. Logan at his back. The minister gave him a hearty good evening, and his heavy red face with its hooked nose beamed benevolently. "'It doesn't look as if you've had much luck,' he said. "'No,' Grant said. "'He had been at it for a whole day and had had nothing. "'They would laugh at him when he got back to Garney.
"'Oh, you're not staying at Carninish House?'
"'No,' Grant said. "'He was staying at the hotel at Garney.' But Mr. Drysdale had very kindly given him permission to fish the Finlay for a day or two.
"'Are the Garney people sending for you?'
"'No,' Grant said. He had intended to walk back when he was tired of fishing. It was only 4 miles or so, and any fish he caught would, of course, be left with Mr. Drysdale.
"'It's very cold work, and disheartening when you've got nothing,' said the minister. "'Won't you come in and have a hot cup of tea at the manse? "'My name is Logan. "'Tea is between 5:30 and 6, and it should be ready now.'
"'Grant thanked him, and tried not to show an indecent degree of joy at the invitation. "'Fate was playing into his hands. "'Once inside the manse, and it would be for him to call the tune.' It was difficult not to bundle his things together, grab the minister by the arm, and run him the half-mile down the river and back to the house. As it was, he packed up with extra deliberation, dawdled at the minister's pace, which had slackened considerably since the early afternoon, down the track, across the bridge, and along the high road to the front of the manse. As the minister led him down the broad path, cut in stretches of grass to the door,
Grant's heart quickened perceptibly, and for once he did not smile at himself for a weakness. 10 days ago Barker had handed over this case to him, and he had been presented with a handkerchief, a revolver, and a blood-stained knife. Now, at the other end of the kingdom, he was about to come face to face with the man he wanted. They divested themselves of their coats and hats in the hall, and Grant could hear through the closed door the chatter and clink of people at tea. Then Mr. Logan stepped over to the door and preceded him into the room. Chapter 12. Capture. It was a dining room, and there were three people having tea at the table. An elderly woman with a faint resemblance to Mrs. Everett, a girl with reddish hair and a pale skin, and the Dago. Grant had time to note them all from behind the minister's bulk before his hosts, making way for him, brought him into their view, and he had the exquisite pleasure of seeing his quarry recognize him. For a second, Lamont's eyes widened at him, then the blood rushed to his face and as suddenly receded, leaving it deathly pale. The looker-on in Grant thought how Danny Miller would have sneered at such an exhibition. Danny, who would kill a man and not bother to remember it. The Dago was certainly an amateur at the game, a murderer by accident more than design, perhaps.
"I have brought you a visitor," the minister was saying. "This is Mr. Grant. I found him fishing, but catching nothing, so I brought him in to get some hot tea. My sister, Mrs. Dinmont, my niece, Miss Dinmont, and a friend of ours, Mr. Lowe. Now, where will you sit?"
Grant was given a seat beside Miss Dinmont and facing Lamont. Lamont had bowed to him when introduced, but so far gave no sign of ill-meditated action. Either he was paralyzed or he was going to take things quietly. And then, as he sat down, Grant saw the thing that made his heart leap. Lamont's cup was on the wrong side of his plate. The man was left-handed.
"I am so glad you didn't wait, Agnes," Mr. Logan said, in a tone which clearly said, "I think you might have waited." "It was such a fine evening that I crossed by the swing bridge and came home by the other side of the river." "Well, we're glad you did," said his niece, "because you've brought Mr. Grant, and that makes an uneven number, and so we can put it to the vote. We've been having a fight as to whether a mixture of race in a person is a good thing or not. I don't mean black and white, but just different stocks of white. Mother says that a single-stock person is the best, of course, but that is because she is solid Highland, back to the flood and before. Logans are MacLennans, you know, and there never was a MacLennan who hadn't a boat of his own. But my father was a borderer, and my grandmother English, and Mr. Lowe's grandmother was an Italian, so we are very firmly on the other side. Now, Uncle Robert is sure to side with Mother, being a purebred Highlander, and having in a purebred degree all the stubbornness and stinking pride of his race, so we are looking for you for support. Do say that your ancestry is tartan."
Grant said, quite honestly, that he thought a mixed strain of more value than a purebred one. That was, talking of purebred, as it can exist today. It gave a man a many-sidedness, instead of giving him a few qualities in excess, and that was a good thing. It tended to cleverness and versatility, and consequently broad-mindedness and wide sympathies. On the whole, he endorsed Miss Dinmont's and Mr. Lowe's point of view. In view of the lightness of the conversation, Grant was astonished at the vehemence and seriousness with which Mr. Logan contradicted him. His race was a fetish with him, and he compared it at length with most of the other nations in Western Europe, to their extreme detriment. It was only towards the end of tea that Grant found, to his intense amusement, that Mr. Logan had never been out of Scotland in his life. The despised Lowlanders he had met only during his training for the ministry some 30 years ago, and the other nations he had never known at all. Frustrated in his effort, nobly seconded by Miss Dinmont, to make light conversation, Grant played the part of a Greek chorus to Mr. Logan and let his thoughts deal with Lamont. The Dago was beginning to look a little better. He met Grant's eyes squarely, and except for the antagonism in his own, there was nothing remarkable about him. He made no attempt to hide the small scar on his thumb, though he must have known, as he knew about his telltale cup, that it was damning evidence. He had evidently decided that the game was up. It remained to be seen, though, whether he would come quietly when the time came. At least Grant was glad to see that flicker of antagonism in his eyes. It is an unlovely job to arrest a craven. A police officer would much sooner be hacked on the shins than clasped about the knees. There would quite obviously be no knee-clasping on this occasion. One thing caused Grant's heart to harden against the man. The strides he seemed to have made in Miss Dinmont's regard in the 3 days of his stay. Even yet his quick smile came out to answer hers, and his eyes sought hers oftener than those of anyone else at table. Miss Dinmont looked a girl who would be quite able to take care of herself. She had all a red-haired person's shrewdness and capability, but that did not excuse Lamont's lack of decent feeling. Had he merely been preparing an ally? A man on the run for murder does not usually have the spare interest for lovemaking, more especially if he is an amateur in crime. It was a blatant and heartless piece of opportunism. Well, he should have no chance of appealing to his ally. Grant would see to that. Meanwhile, he kept his place in the conversation and did justice to the fried trout which was the pièce de résistance of 5:30 tea at the manse. The Dago ate too, and Grant caught himself wondering what degree of effort was required to swallow each of these mouthfuls. Did he care, or had he got past that? Was his impudent, "Don't you think so, Mr. Grant?" a bluff or the real thing? His hands were quite steady. That thin, dark left hand that had put an end to his friend's life. And he did not shirk his part in the conversation. There was obviously, to the others, no difference between the man who sat there now and the man who had sat there at lunch. The Dago was doing it well. At the end of tea, when they began to smoke, Grant offered Miss Dinmont a cigarette, and she raised her eyebrows in mock horror. "My dear man," she said, "this is a Highland manse. If you like to come out and sit on a stone by the river, I'll have one. But not under this roof." The "under this roof" was obviously a quotation, but her uncle pretended not to hear. "There's nothing I'd like better," Grant said, "but it's getting late, and as I am walking to Garney, I think I'd better start. I'm so grateful to you all for the good ending to my day. Perhaps Mr. Lowe would walk a bit of the way with me. It's early yet and very fine." "Certainly," said the Dago, and preceded him into the hall. Grant's adieu to his hostess were cut short by the fear that Lamont would have disappeared, but he found him in the hall, calmly hoisting himself into the trench coat he had worn that morning. And then Miss Dinmont came out to join her uncle, who was seeing them off the premises, and Grant had a sudden fear that she was going to offer to accompany them. Perhaps the resolute way in which Lamont kept his back turned to her daunted her a little. It would have been so natural for him to say, "Won't you come along too?" But he said nothing, kept his back turned, though he knew she was there. That could only mean that he didn't want her, and the suggestion she had been on the point of making died on her lips. Grant breathed again. He had no desire for a scene with an hysterical female, if it could be avoided. At the gate, both men turned to acknowledge the presence of the two at the door. As Grant was replacing his battered hat, he saw Lamont's salutation. It was a mere doffing his cap and donning it again, but Grant had not known that any gesture could be so eloquent of farewell. They walked in silence up the first slight ascent of road until they were well out of sight of the house. At the parting of the ways, where the high road went up the hill and the track to the Crofts branched off along the river, there Grant halted and said, I think you know what I want you for, Lamont.
What exactly do you mean? Asked Lamont, facing him calmly.
I am Inspector Grant from Scotland Yard, and I have a warrant for your arrest for the murder of Albert Sorrell in the Woffington Queue on the night of the 13th. I must warn you that anything you say may be used in evidence against you. I want to see that you have nothing on you. Will you take your hands out of your pockets a moment and let me run you over?
You've made a mistake, Inspector, the man said. I said I'd go a bit of the way with you, but I didn't say how far. This is where I get off.
His left hand shot out of his pocket, and Grant, expecting a revolver, knocked his hand up as it lifted, but even as his eyes closed instinctively, he saw and recognized the blue pepper pot from the manse tea table. Helpless, half-blind, coughing and sneezing, he heard the man's flying feet on the moor track and desperately tried to control himself so that he could hear the direction of the retreating sounds. But it was at least 2 minutes before he could see well enough to be able to follow. A remembrance of that evening in the Strand came to him, and he decided to take his time. No man, even as lightly built as the Dago was, could run for more than a limited time. There was a radius of possibility bounded by the circumference of exhaustion point. And judging by the direction he had chosen when he reached that exhaustion point, the Dago would be in a country that offered him little means of escape. And of course he would be shrewd enough to recognize that. Therefore, the more likely procedure would be that he should repeat the tactics of the Strand evening, lie hidden, probably till darkness made it safe to move, and then return to a better means of escape. Well, Grant thought, the man who has the higher ground commands the situation. A few yards farther on, a small trickle of water came down the hillside. The valley it made was not deep enough to afford him cover standing up, but if he bent, it hid his progress up the hillside from anyone farther along the moor track. With as keen a scrutiny round him as his still smarting eyes would permit, he took to the small gully and bent double, scrambled up it, stopping every few yards to make sure that nothing was in sight and that he himself was still in adequate cover. Farther up, the gully was bordered by stunted birch, and still farther up, it ran through a small plateau, thinly wooded with larger birch. Birch, in its first mist of green, is not ideal cover, but the plateau afforded a first-rate outlook, so Grant decided to risk it. Circumspectly, he raised himself from the sandy bank of the stream to the fine turf of the plateau, and crawled across it to the fringe of thick heather that bordered a drop of several feet in the face of the hillside. From this vantage he had the whole immediate sweep of the valley before him, with the exception of a slab to his right, which was hidden by one of the rectangular patches of firwood so typical of the country. The sight of the firwood reassured him. The firwood would be to Lamont what the door on the other side of Bedford Street had been. He had not the faintest doubt that Lamont was lying there now, waiting for him to declare himself on the road somewhere. What puzzled him was what Lamont thought was going to take the place of the buses and the taxis. What hope had he, other than the darkness? And he must realize that if he waited till dark, Grant would have given the alarm. Already the light was beginning to go. Should he abandon his hiding place and give the alarm, or was that the very thing that Lamont wanted? Would he be playing into Lamont's hands now, if he abandoned the watch and went back to Ray's beaters? He wished he could make up his mind, could see Lamont's play. The more he thought of it, the surer he felt that Lamont was counting on his going back to give the alarm. It was the obvious thing to do. He had given Lamont his chance of going quietly, and he had not taken it, even though his resistance had meant the publication of his true standing. Most assuredly, then, he would expect the inspector to be squeamish no longer about his or other people's feelings, and to go back for help in his capture. That being so, Grant would stay where he was and keep an eye on the country. For a long time he lay there in the dampish, withered heather, looking through the parted fronds at a tranquil strath. Once the brakes of a car squealed away to his left, where the high road came down the hill, and later he saw the car cross the bridge before the village, run like a small black spider along the road at the back of Carninish House, and disappear up the coast road to the north. A sheep bleated far away on the hill, and a late lark sang high in the air, where the sun still was. But nothing moved in the valley but the river, and the slow northern twilight began to settle on it. And then something moved. Down by the river it was. Nothing more definite than the sudden flash of water in the river itself, there and gone again. But it was not the river. Something had moved. Breathlessly he waited, his heart pressed against the turf, beating time with the blood in his ears. He had to wait a while, but what he saw distinctly this time. From behind a huge 12-foot boulder by the river, his quarry slid into sight and disappeared again under the bank. Grant waited again, patiently. Was he going to ground there, or was he making for somewhere? Even in his anxiety he was conscious of that amused indulgence with which a human being watches an unconscious wild animal busy about its own affairs. That tickled feeling that all human beings have when they are spying. And presently a gentle movement farther downstream advertised the fact that Lamont was not stationary. He was heading somewhere. And for a townsman, he was making a wonderful job of cover. But then, of course, there had been the war. Grant had forgotten that Lamont was old enough to have seen active service. He probably knew all that was to be known about the art of taking cover. Grant had seen nothing that second time. He had merely been conscious of movement. He would probably have seen nothing the first time if there had been a better method of getting from that rock to the shelter of the bank than coming into the open. There was no further sign of movement, and Grant remembered that the left bank of the river would afford good shelter nearly all the way. It was time that he abandoned his seat on the dais and went down into the arena. What could Lamont's plan be? If he held to his present course, he would be back at the manse in a quarter of an hour. Was that where he was making for? Was he going to take advantage of the tenderness he had aroused so far-seeingly in the Dinmont girl? A pretty enough plan. If he, Grant, had done as Lamont had suspected and gone back for help, the last place anyone would look for him would be in the manse itself. Grant swore and let himself down the gully again as quickly as the going and his desire to remain in cover would allow. He regained the moor track and hesitated, wondering which was the better plan. Between him and the river stretched a piece of moor, boulder-strewn certainly, but without cover for anything bigger than a rabbit. Only the fir wood, farther on, had enabled Lamont to reach the river unobserved by him. Well, what about going back now and giving the alarm, and catch the man being hidden by the minister's niece? Asked the looker-on in him. Well, why not? He demanded angrily of himself. If she hides him, she deserves all that's coming to her. But there's no need for publicity even yet, urged his other half. Make sure it is to the manse he has gone, and then follow and arrest him there. That seemed sensible enough, and Grant, hoping that no one as far down the river as Lamont was could see him, crossed the little moor to the river at the double. What he wanted was to cross the river. To follow the man down the riverbed was to court certain discovery. He did not want the man to run. He wanted him to go peacefully to ground in the manse, so that he could be pounced upon comfortably. If by any chance he could cross the river, he could keep an eye on the man's progress from the high ground on the other side, could even move parallel with him if he could come up with him, without the man's being aware that he was being stalked. He looked at the torrent. Time was precious, and a wetting was nothing now. It is one thing to dip oneself in icy water in the cold blood of a high resolution, and quite another to plunge into a flood in the heat of a chase. Grant chose a spot where the river was divided into three parts by two large boulders. If he could succeed in negotiating the first one, he could take the second and the bank in a flying leap, and it would not matter very much if he missed the bank, as long as his hands caught at it. He would be across. He stepped back a pace or two and measured the distance to the first boulder with his eye. The first was the flatter of the two, and offered a landing place. The second was pointed, and must be taken on the run. With an inarticulate prayer, he launched himself into space, felt his nailed boots slip as they met the stone, recovered himself, felt the stone heeling over to the black pool beneath, leaped again, but knew, even as he leaped, that the slipping stone had lacked purchase for his spring, met the second stone sideways, and felt his hands on the far bank just in time to prevent himself going in further than to his waist. Thankful and breathless, he pulled himself out, hastily wrung as much of the water from his heavy tweed trousers as would prevent him from being hampered by its weight, and made for the high ground beyond. Never had the moor appeared so treacherous. Dry tussocks of grass melted under his foot into bog, dead brambles clung with a living tenacity to his wet tweed, hidden branches of birch rose and hit him as he stepped on the nearer end, holes waited for his feet among the heather. It was more like a music-hall turn, he thought ferociously, than a serious attempt to overtake a criminal. Panting, he came to a turn of the river and flung himself down to reconnoitre. There was his man, about 50 yards above the manse, moving very slowly and cautiously. It occurred to Grant that it was he, the pursuer, who was having the rough time of it, while the pursued kept a pleasant and well-planned course in the open. Well, it wouldn't be for long. The minute the man turned into that little black gate that they were laughing so serenely over this morning, he, Grant, would be out of the heather and doubling down the cart track by the river, as hard as he could go. He had a small automatic in his pocket and a pair of handcuffs, and this time he would use them, both if necessary. His man wasn't armed, or he wouldn't have stolen the pepper pot from the tea-table, but he wasn't taking risks any longer. No one's feelings would be considered any more in this case, his own least of all. Let every female from here to Land's End have hysterics at once. He wouldn't care. Grant was still fuming and glowering and promising himself all sorts of fancy retributions when the man passed the gate. I have always wished that I could have seen Grant's face at that moment, seen the disgruntled anger and resentment of a man who has tried to do things decently only to have had his decency taken advantage of, changed to the sheer unbelieving astonishment of a small boy beholding his first firework. He blinked hard, but the picture remained the same. What he saw was real. The man had passed the gate. He was now at the end of the manse wall and making for the bridge. What was the fool doing? Yes, Grant thought of him as a fool. He had worked out a perfectly good way of escape for him, to appeal to Miss Dinmont and lie doggo at the manse, and the fool wasn't taking advantage of it. He was near the bridge now. What was he doing? What was in his head? There was purpose in every movement. It was not an aimless or even a particularly furtive progress. He seemed to be too wrapped up in the thought of the business ahead to pay much attention to his present circumstances, beyond an occasional glance behind him up the riverbed. Not that there would be much good looking for cover so near the village, even at this deserted hour when everyone was eating his evening meal and no one was abroad until an hour later they came to smoke pipes in the dusk at the bridge end. There was always the chance of a passer-by, and any appearance of deliberate hiding would defeat its own ends. The man climbed on to the road beside the bridge, but went neither north to the right nor left towards the village. He crossed the road and disappeared onto the river bank again. What could he get there? Was he going to work round to the hotel, which stood on the point, where the river joined the sea, and try to steal the ford? But he had obviously expected Grant to give the alarm. He would never venture up from the shore to the garage after waiting so deliberately to let Grant give warning. The shore. Shore! Good heavens, he'd got it. The man had gone for a boat. They would be lying on the deserted shore, out of sight of the village. The tide was in, just on the ebb, in fact, and not a soul, child or adult, would be abroad to witness his departure. Grant hurled himself down the hillside, cursing in a reluctant admiration of the man's ingenuity. Grant knew the West Coaster, and he had a shrewd idea how often these boats were used. If you stay in a West Coast village, you find that the scarcest commodity of all is fresh fish. It might be literally days before anyone discovered that Mackenzie's boat was missing, and even then they would decide that someone had borrowed it and would save up, the rough side of their tongues, a course which involved no expenditure of energy, for the borrower when he should put it back. Had Lamont sat and thought all that out at the tea at the manse? Grant thought, as his feet touched the cart track, or was it a heaven-sent inspiration in the moment of need? If he had planned it, he thought, racing down the road to the bridge that seemed so strangely distant, then he had also planned that murder in the queue. When one came to think of it, even if one's grandmother was an Italian, one doesn't carry daggers about on the off chance of their being useful. The man was a more accomplished villain than he had given him credit for, in spite of his lack of self-control on two occasions. Long before Grant had reached the cart track in his first avalanche down the hillside, he had decided on his course of action. This morning, when he had emerged from Carninish House with Drysdale, he had noticed a boathouse just beyond the house itself, and protruding from it, alongside the little jetty that led from its shelter to the sea, was what Grant, in retrospect, was sure was the stern of a motorboat. If he was right, and Drysdale was at home, and the light held, then Lamont was as good as caught. But there were three ifs in the affair. By the time he had reached the bridge, he was very nearly winded. He had come from the other side of the valley, and now down this one, in his heavy fishing boots, with his wet tweeds weighing him down. Keen as he was, it required a real effort of will to make him double that last 100 yards up the north road to the gates of Carninish House. Once there, the worst was over. The house lay only a few yards inside the gate, in the narrow strip between the road and the sea. When Drysdale's butler beheld a damp and breathless man at the door, he immediately jumped to conclusions. "Is it the master?" he said. "What's wrong? Is he drowned?" "Isn't he here?" said Grant. "Damn! Is that a motorboat? Can I have a loan of it?" He waved a none too accurate hand towards the boathouse, and the butler looked suspiciously at him. None of the servants had been present at Grant's arrival in the morning. "No, you cannot, my lad," said the butler, "and the sooner you get out of this, the better it will be for you. Mr. Drysdale will make you look pretty small when he comes, I can tell you. Is he coming soon? When is he coming? He'll be here any minute." "But any minute's too late." "Get out," said the butler, "and have one less next time." "Look here," said Grant, gripping him by the arm. "Don't be a fool. I'm as sober as you are. Come down here, where you can see the sea." Something in his tone arrested the man's attention, but it was with obvious fear of personal violence that he approached the sea in company with the madman. Out in the middle of the loch was a rowing boat, being rapidly propelled seawards down the narrow estuary on the ebbing tide. "Do you see that?" Grant asked. "I want to overtake that boat, and I can't do it in a rowing boat." "No, you can't," said the man. "The tide goes out there like a millstream." "That's why I must have the motorboat. Who runs the motor? Mr. Drysdale?" "No, I do, usually, when he goes out." "Come on, then. You'll have to do it now. Mr. Drysdale knows all about me. I've been fishing the river all day. That man has a stolen boat, to begin with, and we want him very badly for other reasons, so get busy." "Are you going to take all the responsibility of it if I go?"
Oh, yes, you'll have the law on your side all right, I promise you that.
Well, I'll just have to leave a message, and he darted into the house. Grant put out a hand to stop him, but was too late. For a second he was afraid that he was not, after all, convinced, and was merely making his escape.